Today's program was brought to you by Mood Magazine, a new international quarterly publication about music and food. For more information, visit moodmusicfood.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We're talking about food.
Food.
We're talking about music.
Music.
We're musical dudes.
Dudes.
Finger on the pulse.
Pulse.
Snacky tunes.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. It is a beautiful Sunday. We are very happy to be here. I am one half your host from Finger on the Pulse there in Bresnitz. Greg Bresnitz is still in London, and I have no idea when he's coming home. Big shout out to Mike Thielen and the entire Feast crew out in Portland. We had a blast. It was such a good time. I can't wait to be back there next year. That was just Ducky, who's going to be back later. This show, super excited to have you back, Ducky, as she's like slinked into a chair. That was just You Turn Me Up, the new single. But first up, we have Alan Salkin. Just speak into the microphone.
Okay.
I can hear you.
I can only hear through one ear. It's annoying.
I'm sorry. Do you want the headphones that work?
It'd be great.
Here, you can take my headphones.
No, 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 I can't do that.
Well, Alan, it's good to have you back. You were on years ago?
I was on 2 years ago.
2 years ago, and every time I saw you, you kept saying, when can I be back on, when can I be back on? And I said, just finish your book.
Yes.
And now you finished your book.
I did, and I...
Is that a big sigh?
It is. As I've been telling people, I feel like I gave birth to a watermelon sideways out my ass.
Wow.
But...
Is that a pull quote?
It's a delicious watermelon.
Yeah, so it is from scratch inside the Food Network.
Yeah.
No, you didn't like any of my titles, did you?
Well, yeah, you did send me some...
What do you need? You need some water, buddy?
No, never mind.
Okay. Well, welcome back to Snacky Tunes. So tell me about this book. I just want to say, I read it cover to cover. I'm done.
Did you read it? What did you like about it?
There's a lot to like about it. I mean, it had a good mix of history and gossip. I can't believe how in-depth it went. I mean, it went back to really the beginning. I mean, from, what was it, Projo up in Providence?
Right.
You know, I gotta say, and maybe you could speak to this, it seems like, for the most part, with the exception of maybe Bobby, everyone got screwed a little.
Bobby would have gotten screwed, except Bobby's Bobby.
Bobby's one of the smartest guys in that
book. It's not that Bobby's smart. It's that Bobby, if you ask him what college, this is Bobby Flay we're talking about. If you ask Bobby what college he went to, he'll say UCLA, which is the university of the corner of Lexington Avenue.
Bobby
is basically a smart street kid who knows how to suss out a situation quickly, figure out who the guys with power are, and how to play it exactly right so the odds are in his favor.
Well, and he also keeps adapting. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. He adapts. Yeah. He is not attached to the past. There's many times since I've written the book where I say, what would Bobby Flay do in this situation?
And he adapted. I mean, it's
he
great.
Adapts.
I mean, you know,
he
in
survives.
Places where, like, you know, Mario and Emerald thought that they were, you know, indestructible and unwilling to change in situation. They wound up getting kicked off the air.
Right. Now, Mario has landed on his feet at the Chew, you know, where he gets a huge audience on, you know, ABC on weekday mornings. But, yeah, Emerald was the king of the network, you know. And when you're king in television, you get money, you get to go to parties, and women ask you to sign their breasts. You know, Mario's, I have a scene in there. You know, the book is not full of scandal. It really is like a great American business success story about something that started from nothing. And there was a lot of skepticism that it could ever work. And it, as you say, it started, in Providence, Rhode Island, from the small cable company, which just happened to be, around the corner from, Johnson and Wales, which is a leading cooking school. So the idea kind of emerges from these guys there who don't even like food. A lot of the guys, it was just a cable business play at a time when there was only 35 cable channels, and they knew there was going to be 500 someday, what the universe we're living in now. Of course, now there's 5 million jillion because of the internet, but
yeah.
They saw there was going to be this expansion and you know, placed their bets, and there was a lot of skepticism, and it grew, and there were certain people, and the first real breakthrough cultural hit, I mean, probably the first show you saw was, or noticed, was Emerald Live. It was this new kind of cooking show.
It was late night. I mean, it was late night at 8 p.m., and it was a band and things like that. I mean, I think people forget. And I remember when cable expanded, and then especially with satellite, there were just so many channels that just didn't make it. And then they were just breaking it down genre by genre. And it's amazing to think, and because now you're looking back and go, oh, the Food Network is such, food is such a part. Obviously, we're sitting in a radio Food Network.
But the Food Network, we wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for these guys in Providence. The Food Network, what the Food Network did was it found this sort of nascent, you know, food culture that was percolating in places like Berkeley, with, you know, obviously Chez Panisse, with Wolfgang Puck in LA. And then in downtown New York, and in a time of recession, there were a lot of young chefs who had opened some interesting places. Bobby had opened Mesa Grill in 91, the night the Gulf War started.
Amazing.
And Mario had Poe, and even Tom Colicchio was cooking at the Gramercy Tavern. So the Food Network, because they had no choice, they were just looking for content to throw in the air. This is who there was. So they found these chefs, and they just kept testing them and throwing them up on the air. and seeing what works. And from that, you got Emerald Live and Bobby Flay.
Chilling and Grilling, right?
Chilling and Grilling was his first show. It was with Jack McDavid, a chef or barbecue guy from Philadelphia. They shot the show 42 episodes in 7 days on the back lot of HSN in Florida, and it was $1,800 an episode.
I mean, that's one of the things that amazed me the most, having done production work and being involved with television. I think the most shows we ever banged out was when I worked on Boy Meets Grill, and we would do 3 episodes a day, and it was way more than $800. The fact that at the beginning of the whole network, they could do 5 episodes, 6 episodes a day.
Yeah, Emerald tried to do 8.
I mean, it was pretty much live to tape.
There was a no-stopping rule. You could cut yourself. Mario's first episode of Molto Mario, he was showing how to make a marinara sauce and sliced his finger when he was grating the carrot, and grated his finger into the mix. Looked up, expected to hear that he was supposed to stop. Nobody said stop. He wrapped his hands in a towel, slowly bled while he kept making it. They went to commercial. He stuck his hand in a bowl of tomatoes, just kept bleeding into the tomatoes. And, you know, to his credit, and this shows again and again, the people who survived, even Rachel Ray, her first pilot for 30-minute meals, the staff was so confused by this format because there was really no prep to do. The idea was she was going to go to the refrigerator
right. And
do what you could do in 30 minutes. And she really does do that, by the way. I saw her do it.
It's amazing.
She's the Babe Ruth of food television. She is at the most natural.
Does she just point one finger to the kitchen?
She points one finger at who's ever there and beckons you over after like 35 minutes, and you eat what she's made, and it's actually pretty good. Although, you know, that even that show, they're not producing anymore. That's another story. But
she's got her talk show now.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, I mean, this is the thing that I saw about the book, and I definitely want to talk to you about the research, is just that, like, everyone sort of reaches the end, like all the big stars, and a lot of it has to do with, like, well, we just have so much content. It's like you're so good at your job, and we just don't need to spend any more money on you.
That does happen. As I say in the book, everybody ends up as a crocodile food in the moat eventually. But that's true, and yet what's happened is there also may not be the same appetite for the dump and stir, the classic Julia Child-style cooking show.
There's not.
There isn't.
it's just not. It's just, I mean, even with YouTube, it's how many more baked chicken recipes do you need to see? You know, how many more times do
right.
you need to
we
see?
Right, we know how to keep that. Even though I've written this book and I'm a pretty good cook and watched many cooking shows, I still can't manage to keep the damn skin crisp on my roast chicken.
You gotta truss it and then uncover it in the last like
the
10
minutes. Trussing. Anyway.
We'll do a trussing party afterward.
Where's my free pizza?
Pizza's coming. On that note, we're going to take a break because I want to come back. Yeah. I want to talk about the research process and then the future. We're going to have a packed house today.
Yeah.
All right, so this is a song that actually, I mean, Damien's back in the house from Girly, and this is just a song from XNY because that album is actually really, really good. And that was our show 2 weeks ago. This is right on off the album Orange here on Snacky Tunes.
Change the world. I was helpless a mile ago. Well, I'm just about to end it all, and here I am looking for a way out. It took a heavy heart to hold me down. I was running blind. I was leaving all your secrets, so I longed to keep them. Take a look, it'll do you good. It's not for you, it's for the children. I'm keeping time with all your baby rhymes. Better if we kill them. If we get out, it's not about us, it's for them. I swear to God. And I'm not good for you. I got trouble, I can't speak up. I can't keep to myself. Used to you. I got bigger things to
like a drug. I hold my song and let my mind get bigger. It's bound to get me by. If they think I'm gonna die, 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 die. Hey! Were you bound to me? Were you? Were you chained up like a dog in heat? I can't believe you bite my leg and tie my feet and tell me to run.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. That was just Ride On by X and Y, who were our guests last time. Really awesome. So nice. What a nice pair. We have Alan Salkin in the hot seat talking about his new book, From Scratch, Inside the Food Network. And it's a great read. I think I read it in about 2 weeks. Good stuff in there. My question is, you go back to a pre-internet time and it didn't seem like they were keeping any sort of notes, and you get a real sense of how the whole network started. I mean, two conversations that happened 30 years ago.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
Well, I interviewed a hell of a lot of people, and you know, I used to work at the New York Post in the 90s, and something I learned then was you gotta show up. You gotta put your ass in the way of people, and you will get material. As you know, and that's the test. It's scary. But this is the test. You get parachuted into situations, and you just try to live by your wits. I remember when I was at the Post, and Michael Jackson, who is a deceased, very famous pop singer, but at the time was alive, and I was just posted outside his hotel once, waiting to see if he came out and said anything. And what I ended up getting was somebody from the kitchen came out and described the food they had sent up to his room, which was like vanilla cake with vanilla icing. Every piece of everything had to be wrapped in saran wrap, and I got a great story just by standing for, you know, 8 hours. And this is not my proudest moment, but this is the same thing I basically brought to this book over a period of 3 years. Any conversation that you see in the book that's quoted means that somebody who was in the room at the time told me it. But it was also a case of Rashomon. I mean, many people, six different people claim to have invented Emeril Live, including Emeril. He didn't.
You really give due justice, though, to people. Like, you, I really feel that you didn't just go be like, well, Emeril says that he created it. Like, you really not only do the research, but then you call the people out.
Yeah, I did. And there's one president of the network, sort of the third president. There's been like five. Erica Gruen, who every single person other than Erica told me, don't believe anything Erica says. And that actually turned out not to be true. A lot of what Erica said did add up, but I just had to take everything she said, everything everybody said, and just start to measure it. And does this add up to this? It's just like a mystery. I mean, I was like a, you know, Philip Marlowe plus Raymond Chandler, you know, plus, you know, the guy from The Shining trying to write this book without going completely nuts.
Now, what's the feedback been from the network? Has anyone reached out to you?
An overwhelming maw of silence.
Right.
So what's happened is...
So that means you must have done it right.
I think so. Well, you know, I don't understand. I don't have Rachel Ray and Mario Batali banging on the counter at the Food Network kitchens. There is some good juicy stuff. Like, I do have them at a strip club and stuff. But,
right.
But there's nothing...
You know, I've heard that story before.
Yes.
Like, none of the stories... None of the stories...
This is the first time you've ever heard it.
Well, I heard it from you.
Right. Okay.
But, I never... Like, nothing in there was like... Was
it's
like,
a great...
Holy
they should
shit.
Be embracing this book. It is a great business success story about something that started from nothing and is now at turning 20 this month, and or next month. And is worth almost $10 billion, or is maybe $6 billion to $10 billion. And they should be embracing the book. And I treated everybody with respect, you know, and told it like it was. But the truth is, they're like Disneyland. They don't want you to see their characters without their masks on.
Of course. But I don't think... I guess it's different because being in the field, being intimate with some of these personalities in the book, I don't think that there's some veneer, but I guess if you're removed from it and you're just watching on TV, there is this facade of perfection.
That's and this is where the network has gone wrong, because you know what happened in like 98 was Scripps, which is a Knoxville based company, bought this crazy New York company, which was like, you know, operating a food network on the 30th floor of an office building with not proper ventilation, tapping into the sprinkler system for water and having the sinks empty into slop buckets. I mean, this is the sort of culture clash, these crazy New Yorkers and these Midwestern Southerners. And that is, you know, this is what happened with Top Chef. This is why when Food Network President Brooke Johnson, who's still the president, says, the biggest mistake I made was not trying to come up with something to answer Top Chef immediately after the first season when I saw it was a hit. And the answer is, you couldn't have. That wasn't your culture.
No.
Top Chef is a show that shows the gritty nature of the people who work in kitchens, you know, that all the tattooed craziness and homosexuality, and it's very, you know, everything that's, you know...
Well, it's not G-rated.
It's not G-rated, and Food Network does not have the culture to actually present that kind of show, nor do they want to spend the kind of money it takes to produce that level of quality of a show. So... You know, that shows through again and again that chefs are pretty crazy people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, fact.
Yes. And the network has never quite reconciled taking these crazy people and trying to turn them into consumer products for mass consumption. And obviously the worst case of this is Paula Deen.
Oh, my God. I was surprised that you actually got that into the book.
Yeah.
Because I thought that it had gone to print before that scandal happened.
Yeah, the galley did. But what happened was, I luckily was so late getting... We wanted to publish the book in time for the 20th anniversary this fall.
Well done.
And luckily, I was so late that all that went down, and I had a week. And I was actually, like, part of it, I was even traveling on a river rafting trip in Idaho.
As one does.
Yeah, but I was getting up at 4 in the morning, calling all my sources, and I had a week to write and report. And I think I did a pretty good job. And... of getting new stuff in there about this that people don't know about the way that Food Network was already upset with her about the diabetes deal she'd made a year earlier. They were already had crisis communications people figuring out how to get this problem away from them. Because now that you have a $6 to $10 billion company that's expanding into Africa and Asia with new food channels, you can't have anybody associated in any way with racism who's just unpredictable.
Well, racism is so taboo in America. Of all the things, I mean, you could lie about more or less anything, but if you get labeled a racist, you're pretty much.
No, I know. That's what happened to the show you guys replaced here on the Heritage Network, right? There was some.
Yeah, there were some really big things. Someone said derogatory things about chickens, and it just got way out of hand. What was your favorite story? What was the thing that blew you away the most that you've discovered? What was the thing that surprised you?
I love the little weird minutia, which you'll probably realize, the people who read the book, like, yeah, there's some. You know, there's big arching themes, and, you know, there's a funny story about how the pilot of Chopped.
The dog, right?
Yeah, actually involved the chopped dish in each segment would get scraped into a dog dish and fed to a ravenous chihuahua named Pepe. They cut that part out when it finally made it to air. But I like two things come to mind. One was Julia Child was a guest frequently. Under contract in the early days of the network. She wasn't allowed to cook because of her contract with PBS and ABC for Good Morning America, but she would appear. And she would. There's a story where she's sitting in the makeup chair with a bag of McDonald's French fries in one hand, and she's falling asleep in the chair, and the makeup artist is trying to get the makeup on her. But even though Julia's slumping down in her chair further and further, she never loses her grip on the bag of McDonald's French fries.
Golden arches for forever.
So I like that, and then I also just like, you were talking about the internet, and I just love the story of how somebody just goes, oh, maybe we should put some of those recipes online. Maybe that would be a way to solve our problem, because they were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars a year mailing recipes to viewers who requested them, and they had to spend money on stamps. This was actually the way they got their ratings. The shows that got the most recipe requests were the most popular.
I mean, it's easy to look back. It's like those like old-timey movies with like future humor, where you go, yeah, of course you put stuff on the internet, but back then they're just like, is this thing going to stick? This is going to be a thing?
Internet? And it also cost $100,000 to start a site, and this was a network that didn't make money until it was about 8 or 9 years old. And the first company that they came in that offered to build an internet site said, we went to the trouble of buying now, the network was called Television Food Network to start, TVFN. These people came in and said, we went to the trouble of buying your domain, TVFN, for you, and it'll be $100,000 to start the website. And they said, no, can we have our domain name back? No, you can't. So they ended up going with Food TV, and that's still, if you type in foodtv.com, we'll bring you to Food Network.
Absolutely.
So it's just all kinds of crazy stuff like that. But it's really, there's so that, and then you have, my job as a writer was to add it up into almost like a novelistic telling, where you have this great business story plus these great characters who come and go, and, you know, all the madness that ensues. And then where are we now, you know?
Yeah, what is the future?
I know you'd like to know. We've talked about that. But
I've gotten out of the game.
You'll be back.
Yeah.
Or not. I think the future is, I think what's going to happen is the original promise of the 500 channel universe is going to finally come true. The idea was that with all those channels, you could actually have niche networks that get fed people's interests in a narrow casting. And that Food Network at its best, I think, is this like hearth that you can gather around. It's like men watch ESPN because it's sort of pseudo war. And all of us like watching a cooking show on some level because it's like going back to the hearth where, you know, somebody's standing by a fire cooking something delicious. And it just hits us in our archetypes. And I think that what's happened in cable is everybody wants to find the new number one hit. Everybody wants to be number one. Nobody wants is happy being number 10 and just making a good living. And I think that is where we're going. And all the cable companies are fighting against a la carte. Right, everybody that you and I know is getting rid of their cable because they don't want to pay $120 a month for cable. We want to pay $5 for ESPN, a few bucks for Bravo, and that might be enough. You know, some
HBO. $200 just to get through AMC tonight, right?
Yeah, right. Of course, don't let me forget AMC. And those people have earned our money, but we don't want, you know, all the crap. And they're all fighting this, but it's like everything else. It is what everyone wants. It is what's going to happen. And I think we will end up getting some simple, nice cooking shows through whatever format we get them. And, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what happens like everybody else.
I am. So last question. Joe Langan, the guy who sort of came up with the whole idea for the Food Network and got cut out of the profits.
Yeah.
That actually was probably the toughest thing to find out about, that he really did not see any of this empire financially. What's he doing now? Is he okay? Did he make it all right out through?
You know, I saw Joe. We were on a panel at the New School a couple nights ago, and he's going to be at the book party on Tuesday night. And, you know, Joe is a guy who invented the Food Network. He also basically invented Court TV.
Right.
There's a, you know, great story in there of how that happened, and he's just, it just shows you, like, money, you know, all that stuff, it doesn't feed the soul. And
no.
Joe just is just happy as long as he can just be set upon the next new idea. And we stood on the street corner the other day, and he was just telling me about this quantum way of, like, working on you know, search engine optimization. Maybe we should use it to sell the book, and he'll give it to these guys. He's working on another, you know, internet play of putting cooking shows on newspaper websites. And so he's just on to the next project. He's living happily up in somewhere, you know, to me, everything in north of Boston is whatever, you know. It's like
I feel that way about north of 14th Street.
Gray. And yeah. But anyway, he's one of the happiest and most open people that I met in this whole process, unlike the people who are at Food Network now who seem to be, you know, reflecting the sort of knife-like, you know, competition you see on the network every night of just like the ratings are going down. Everyone's, you know, scared and bitter and, you know, distancing themselves from my book as if it's something to be scared of because nobody knows what's happening and everything makes them paranoid.
Yeah. Well, Alan, it's a great read. When's it come out officially?
It comes out October 1st. I've got a you know, you can go on Amazon. It's From Scratch Inside the Food Network. But my I have a Tumblr, which is allensalkin.tumblr.com, and it's A-L-L-E-N-S like Sam, A-L-K-I-N, allensalkin.tumblr.com, where you get a lot of even extras and videos and stuff. Oh,
yeah? It's great. It's a great read.
Thank you.
From start to finish.
I'm going to put that on the Amazon page. It's a, you know,
it's a great read.
The Bresnitz Boys, yeah.
Pull quote from the Bresnitz Boys. Well, listen, we're going to jam with some free pizza. Alan, thank you so much. And we'll have you next when you write your next book, right?
No, sooner than that.
Sooner than that. We'll have you back again. Well, congratulations. I'm really happy.
I've been looking forward to this literally for 3 years or whatever it was.
Me too. And I was happy to... I mean, I'll put it this way. Like,
I only finished the book so that I could come back to this, which is the greatest radio studio in New York.
It's the best radio studio. Well, you know what? I did my duty. I read it from cover to cover, which I really wanted to do before you came on. And it's... I gotta say, it's up there with like United States of Arugula, like all those books. If you care about cable television, food, anything like that, it's great. I would love to see more books like about it, to see if the Food Network and the Cooking Channel were the only like cable sort of story that went that way. Because it seemed like HGTV, which you talk about in the book, seemed like to be more of a success from the start. Like it was in the black much sooner, but that's for another time.
I think, they're all great stories, and they're all facing an uncertain future. I think even AMC, it could be a good book.
I mean, AMC is, you know, with them just saying that they're going to do the Mad Men finale in two parts over a year, and the fact that they haven't really been able to get, I mean, I guess they have The Walking Dead, but they're about to lose two of their biggest shows in a year.
But, you know, another guy who has a book coming out this week wrote an oral history of Nickelodeon, which I know is a great story.
Oh, that sounds like a good read. And there's some people from Nickelodeon who show up in your book.
Yes, yeah. There's the Slimers who made it from Nickelodeon in the 80s to the Food Network in the 90s. And,
amazing.
And contributed to founding Iron Chef.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Alan. We're going to have a new song from The Blow, and then we have Eli from Olympic Provisions coming up next. Here we go. I Tell Myself Everything off self-titled The Blow.
I like not getting what I want. I guess I'm just reporting what the facts suggest. I read my journals. It appears I like torture a lot, and it's hot problem. Try your cool maneuvers on me if you got them. My endurance is awesome, but I'm not as easy to woo as I once was. Since I got jumped by the girl of the month club, I ascended from dumper to dumper. Remind me sometime. I heard a rumor that I was amazing. I'd sell myself everything I hear about this. I heard a rumor that I was amazing. I knew that it was bad when she bought the crucifix earring at the yard sale. Cause that man was an actual witch, and when I wish for pain, I get my wish. One good heartbreak and you'll sing for a decade. This one could be in the middle age. I was splayed, I said, go ahead. Walks a nurse from a hot French movie, tells me she can do things to me. I like getting things done to me, or just then getting wrecked seem more fun to me. Besides, pleasure writes fewer good songs, so I kicked out the nurse. Well, we did some stuff first. I heard a rumor that I was amazing. I'd sell myself everything I hear about this. I heard a rumor that I was amazing. You eat, I starve for affection. I ate every eyeball in my direction. I was desperate for someone to mess with me. So if you could do it successfully, here we come in a slow motion strut. It's all for me.
And I walk back in my classes.
I'm sorry. I may go out there this week.
I heard a rumor that I was amazing. I'd sell myself everything I hear about myself. I heard a rumor that I was amazing.
All right. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. That was just The Blow off her new album. She played a short set at Pianos on Thursday, and she still got it. She still got it. Kayla, rocking it. Doing a lot of improv stuff. Super 90s. I mean, I guess late 2000s. We got Eli Cairo in from Olympic Provisions, all the way from Portland. Eli, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for having me.
I met Eli last week at Feast, and he was gracious enough to show Jamie and I a tour of his unbelievable meat processing facility, which is on-site, FDA approved.
USDA.
USDA. Not FDA?
Different worlds.
Different worlds.
USDA deals meat.
Okay. Close enough. Yeah. We do, just like Alan Salkin, we do some really hard-hitting investigation. We make sure that we get all of our facts right before we go to air. I wonder if we go back and we just add up all of the mistakes that we made. Probably be its own show unto itself. Well, Eli, welcome. You're in town for Star Chefs ICC.
Yep.
And we did an event together yesterday, the Smoke at ICC, which was this insane 10-chef barbecue competition. Shout out to the Carillion from Austin, Texas, for taking the home, the bacon. Yeah. They did awesome food. Everyone was great.
Everything was great. There was not one piece of barbecue that was not just delicious.
There was the 10 brisket samples and then all the then 30 other dishes from other proteins, and I had a little sample of everything. I did not feel great at the end of the day, but there was no miss. It was crazy.
Right.
It was a lot of fun, and then you butchered a goat.
I did, or a lamb. They couldn't find the goat, so I butchered a lamb.
Right, okay.
Which is nice. It was a change. It's probably the first lamb I butchered in 3 years.
It was sort of weird because you left the stage, and then they just had a table, and like the lamb was just sitting there.
I know, right?
Like there wasn't anyone, like, and there wasn't anybody sort of watching the table. I don't really know what. Hopefully, it got used today.
Yeah, they told me not to break it down into like butcher portions, like steaks and whatnot, because they're reusing it for something today. But yeah, I was sitting out there for a bit.
Cost effective.
I tell you what, you know.
So Olympic Provisions, yep. For those who don't know what it is, what is it?
In 2009, we opened up Oregon's first USDA-approved curing facility and a real nice restaurant. And it was right next door to each other. The idea was to allow me to, you know, ferment and mold meat naturally and distribute it across America.
Let's go back a little bit because of all the stories that I've heard of people, this is not some... Well, you know, I thought I'd go into the business. Like, this is the real deal, in your blood, from birth.
Sure.
Seems like this was, if not the only path, a very strong chance that you were going to wind up here. So what's the brief nuts and bolts of your history?
Yeah, my dad moved to Greece. I was born in Salt Lake City, Utah. We made everything at home, from liquor, glue, meat. We raised everything, huge farm.
Pause. What did you make the glue out of?
Sap.
Oh, okay.
Greeks do that in sap and, you know, rice flour.
I heard glue, comma, meat, and I was like, okay, whose hooves got it?
So progressive. No, like sap. And so, you know, we made everything. We had two restaurants, like most Greeks do. And I kind of knew I wasn't very good at school, and I knew I was going to be in food. I always loved, you know, working in the restaurants and butchering and hanging out with my dad and everything. And then when I got kicked out of high school, my father said I had to go to apprenticeship.
You just going to gloss over that?
A little bit.
Okay.
You know, I was busy.
Yeah, busy.
You know, you have stuff going on when you're young.
Freedom. Yeah.
Freedom.
Freedom. America, right?
That's right. Living out there.
So he sent you to Chicago, right?
I was going to go to Chicago, then I was going to go to the CIA, and my uncle that owns a restaurant in Chicago had a friend in Switzerland that had apprentice, and they said that, you know, he actually knew how to use his hands and cook a bit, you should take him on for 6 months. And I got there, and it was an amazing place, like full wild butchery. So if any animal shot in the valley, you had to bring it through us. So we'd see, you know, 200 ibex, 100 some elk a year, you know, lots of deers and everything, and learn to totally process that. We'd forage chanterelles and make all of our jellies and hang out with real cheesemakers up in their Alps. It was a huge opportunity. And then, you know, I was really young this time, so 19 probably by the time this is all going around, and I already knew that it was too good to leave. So I stayed there for 5 years. Came back to Portland, Oregon. Really, really loved it. Saw the farmers markets. Saw the, you know, great cheesemakers and coffee roasters and everything else that was going on. And instantly, after 2 weeks there, I told my sister I really wanted to make charcuterie. And, yeah.
And then, so that's it? You're like, I'm going to make charcuterie, and then that's...
I worked at some really epic charcuterie spots in Switzerland, where we're, you know, 200-year-old, Bootner Fleischmakers and everything great like that. And I just came back and didn't see the product that I really wanted to see. You know, you couldn't find a natural.
Did you go back to Salt Lake or did you go to Portland?
Portland, straight to Portland. My sister moved up there and we're family. We stay really close to each other.
Those Greeks, right?
I tell you what, everyone, my mom, my sister, my niece, my brother, my older sister, we all work for Olympic Provisions now.
Typical. Really?
Typical.
Family affair.
Typical.
So you get back to Portland, and what year is this?
Sheesh, what is it? 2009, 8, 7, 6. It's 2006. Is that true? Yeah.
So Portland was already in its start of its food renaissance, becoming a place.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it was sort of the beginning.
Sure. Let's see. Stumptown's been open for, you know, God, when did Dwayne start that? 2004-ish, you know?
Yeah.
2004. He was there. We had all the, you know, Willamette cheese, Malala cheese makers. We had every microbrew that you can imagine already. You know, yeah. Windmere, Rogue, and all these great beer makers, tons of winemakers, and, you know, even chocolate makers with Moonstruck and all these people. It was, you know, it rains a lot in Portland. We sit inside and we tinker with shit, all stuff all day long.
No, you can say shit. It's the internet. So you saw no product that you wanted.
Yeah, it sounds super arrogant.
No, that's fine.
But you know what I mean? Yeah. There wasn't a lot of just quality product. I mean, you couldn't find like a natural piece of salami with mold on the outside. You couldn't find high quality pork. It was all the commodity pork that was, you know, really tangy and, you know, they didn't naturally ferment and all these things. And that's just the way I learned. And that's the meat that I enjoyed eating. So.
You don't have to say who, but were there people who were trying to do artisanal sauce at the time and you're like, this is just terrible?
I don't think it was. It was actually, you know, just the real big guys. And then Framani, of course, came on, and Framani did an amazing job. You know,
right.
They made very, and still do make very, very delicious meats. And so that was very exciting. But that wasn't, you know, that was kind of restaurant and deli meat. And I wanted it to be kind of like every person in Portland should be eating my meat and then hopefully go from there.
Wow. So how did you start the process?
I went to my sister and told her that I really wanted to do this, and she said she had $20,000 she'd loan me.
Okay.
And I
nice.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was nice. Sweet. And I emailed the head of the USDA and asked her, and I was like, her name's Dr. Barrow's, a great lady, is it possible to make meat in this form or fashion? And she said, I was crazy. There's probably no way. You better have a lot of background in meat science. And I said, I really don't. You know, you have to go do HACCP classes and all these, you know, big scary words at first. And she worked with me. I just took 2 years off of any fun. I didn't do anything for summers. I sat and learned meat science and just, you know, did the USDA dance.
Favorite thing you learned?
What, excuse me?
Favorite thing you learned?
Favorite thing I learned? Probably HACCP. Like that, the CFRs, like the federal regulations, I can read that like a beach read now. Like, I love the meat science. It's super interesting to me.
Alan, yeah. I hope that doesn't top you out at New York Times bestseller.
What?
The CFRs for meat now.
Just all this talk of like meat and sausage and stuff. The one thing about Portland that amazed me was that they actually have non-transvestite streetwalkers when we were visiting. Like, they actually have old-time real prostitutes on the streets there, which we no longer have in New York.
Yeah.
It's and a steakhouse strip club.
With a great salad bar.
The vegan strip club.
No. Acropolis. Which... we never quite met.
Anyway, I took it down. Met. This guy's talking about his wonderful career. And I really want to hear about that.
That has a lot to do with my beautiful career.
So your sister gives you $20,000.
Yeah.
You take 2 years off of being fun.
Yeah.
And then what happens then? Are you making sausage? Are you like experimenting?
Yeah, I was the executive chef of a restaurant at Castagna. And that's how I paid my days. I was working and cooking and doing all that stuff. And at the time I was trying to work with the USDA and develop HACCP plans and, you know, make meat. We had a huge charcuterie program at the restaurant, but I wanted to make it my thing. At this time, my good friend Nate Tilden, it's the Clyde Common, he came to me and he said that he was going to open up a charcuterie focused restaurant. And I was like, God, that's, you know, kind of what I'd like to do too. I have $20,000. Do you want to do this together? And he was like, that's not very much money. Wow. And anyways, they allowed me to kind of join in with them. And I said I would do the meat part. They could do the restaurant stuff. And it's been awesome. I mean,
and that was the birth of Olympic Provisions.
The birth of Olympic Provisions.
So you have one store, and now you have your second store,
yep.
Which is where you do all of, well, you're
currently
you do all your processing, which is crazy.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the timing, because I'm still fascinated
know,
by the
fast.
Hours.
Of
like when you can and when you can't actually process meat.
Sure. The USDA gives you, you know, governed hours because you're only allowed 40 hours a week to process under their watchful eye. And so you have to start whatever hours they say and whatever hours they end. They have to swing by and, you know, they'll meet you some days at 6:30 in the morning and they'll walk through your entire plant with a flashlight and, you know, they'll look over anything, grab your paperwork. If anything's wrong, they could close you down. it's not that bad. That we'd like to keep clean. We like to be hygienic. We like to keep our paperwork organized. So the USDA loves us. We have a very.
You want
to
shout out your guy?
I can't. No, Dr. Barros is amazing. She's the who's my inspector?
Yeah, but who was the guy on site that we met?
I can't remember who was there. Right now we have three rotating through.
So the process is crazy because you're doing the actual butchering. It's all pork.
Yeah, we do all pork, and that just makes it easy.
Yeah, and so you do that, and then you do the smoking, the drying, and then the molding.
Yeah, we do all we run a full shop, so we do a smokehouse where we do all kielbasas, bacon, hams, fermenting salami, and then we dry cure, and we also do pâtés and rillettes and fresh sausages for all the beer houses and everything in Portland. So,
and you're national, right? You can get it anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we are in 36 states, and we have 20-some distributors.
Wow. Where can people get it in Brooklyn?
In Brooklyn, our first customer is Marlo Sons and Daughters, and then Brooklyn Kitchen has been there forever. Geesh, I should be better at this. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you got two. That's good. That's what we PR
Thanks.
People, right?
Perfect. It's solid.
So you're building. Can I talk about what you're
Please,
building?
Please, absolutely.
So you have a new facility. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how much meat you're putting out at the one current facility a day or a week. How much you're putting out?
We put out roughly 10,000 pounds of meat a week. And we do.
That's 5 tons for all those people with calculators.
It's a lot of pork. And there's only 6 butchers. Counting myself, so we do that processing, just the 6 of us.
So pretty much like you're doing like about a ton.
Yeah, you get after it. It's good. Wow. You know, it's the luckily the guys that work with me are very experienced meat makers, and
I would imagine
get after it and they love it. And it's once you start, it's kind of hard to get off, you know.
But you got a new space coming, right?
Big space coming. We've grown out of this space, so we're completely allocated. We can't sell our meat anywhere else. We're bursting at the seams, and so we just got a 35,000 square foot warehouse, and we're cutting concrete, and everything else is going great right now.
Oh my god,
it's gonna be awesome.
You built these restaurants by hand by yourself, right?
Yeah, actually the most exciting thing about the big warehouse that we have is we finally have our own steel shop on site, so we can weld everything for our restaurants and all of our meat shops right on in the meat plant. Well, not in the meat plant, but on site anyways.
So right now the demand has sort of outgrown the supply a little bit?
Absolutely, yeah. We can't say yes to opening to new markets.
That's a good problem to have.
I hope so, yeah, I think so.
Are you trying to get in all 50 states?
I want to get into the ones that we really enjoy first, the people that really appreciate what we're doing.
Do you have like a bottom 50 that you don't like of the states?
I don't know if I do yet. As long as they love it, I think I could be convinced. If it's somebody that's always, they just snoot their nose and are like, it's expensive meat, it sucks, then I won't go there. But
is it all this talk of the steel shop? And it really struck me in Portland that it really is like Brooklyn. It's like Portland is Brooklyn West. Mm-hmm. Being in Roberta's, doesn't this feel like a...
Exactly, yeah. This could be my Southeast restaurant. It has the same vibe. Everybody here, you can see it's happy, friendly people. It's great.
Well, we don't have a goat farm in the middle of town, though.
You don't have a goat? We can get one.
We can get one.
The goats will live anywhere. Let's put some out somewhere.
Do you guys ship internationally? You guys have plans for that?
Not right now, but we sure if somebody was willing.
Will Switzerland be your first stop?
That'd be awesome. Could you imagine?
Sort of full circle, right?
That'd be cool as heck.
So if people wanted to order or get any of the sausage, where can they go or where can they check out?
Yeah, go to our website, olympicprovisions.com. There's a great store there. And we'll ship it next day. You can get anything. You can try the pâtés, all of our fresh sausages, everything.
That's awesome. Well, Eli, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you so much
for having me. I'm sorry your girlfriend couldn't make it because I know she wanted the pizza.
She'll be here. She's coming later. Oh, yeah. She's going to come later.
Okay. Awesome. We'll stick around. We got Ducky coming up next. We have her penultimate single.
I was going to say the same thing.
What?
I have a microphone.
Yeah. So here we go. This is Air, the day version, and this is the mastered version.
I mean, the only one that's out is the mastered version. You know, I like to think of myself as a professional.
Yeah. All right, here we go. Ducky on Snacky Tunes. We'll be right back.
There is a space where you used to sit. We watched the East River get all lit up like us. Oh yes, it felt so glamorous to know that our blood was toxic, like words we used to say just to keep each other warm in the false sense of cold, 'cause the AC was on. But I couldn't get up, and your chivalry didn't extend past the bed that we lived in that month. 'Cause I don't wanna wait till your hands go numb, beating on your chest with my fist, just so you can breathe the air, the air. Oh, 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 you make me scared. There is a hole that I used to fill with bruises buried in the valley of my arms.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. That was just Ducky. Welcome back.
Thank you.
That was a double welcome back. That's a little MIA.
Yeah, that was my iPod shuffle right there.
There we go.
Coming in.
Yeah? When you pop up on your shuffle, do you skip the track or do you listen to yourself?
It depends on the track.
Really? All right. We won't call out your individual tracks. So what? It's been a minute since you've been on the show.
It's been a long time.
What you been up to, Ducky?
A lot. In the time since I was last here, I have graduated college.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
How did that all play out?
Graduating college?
Yeah.
I got honors and an award for my department, so
there you go.
Tell me. I'm not trying to brag or anything.
Well, I asked.
You didn't offer it.
Did your dancers graduate?
They did. We actually all graduated the same year, and we all walked on the same stage.
Did you guys throw an after party or something?
Did we? Oh, you know what? That was actually when I was DJing at the Ace, I believe.
Okay.
So my after party was a six-hour lounge DJ set. Lounge being the location,
23-year-old me would say that's awesome. 31-year-old me says that sounds like a lot of time.
It was... I had a few songs, like, on reserve for when I needed to pee. I can say that that was about the only difficult part for me, was picking, like, the appropriate 12-minute song to, like, run through a crowd of people, find the women's bathroom, wait in line, get back.
Everyone needs their bathroom songs.
Absolutely.
Everybody.
DJ Standard.
That would be actually a good compilation.
Bathroom songs.
We
might have to rename it.
Yeah. So you graduated, and you did not decide to leave New York.
I did not. I don't really know where else I would go, honestly.
Where are you from?
I'm from San Francisco.
Okay. Yeah, you don't want to go back there.
Let's stipulate that I love San Francisco, but I lived there for 17 years. I think I can spend a few more years here.
Were you living in the dorms or did you move out?
I lived in the dorms my freshman year, and then I actually moved out before the end of my freshman year of college due to some housing probation rules that I was
it's fine. I got into the same issues. I think Eli got into those in high school. Mm-hmm. But you all, I mean, I don't know what they think is going to happen when they put like 30,000 18-year-olds in housing,
right?
In New York, and not think that bad stuff is going to happen.
Well, I thought the funniest part was that if you got caught smoking weed, they sent you to a weed smokers class about, like, I don't know, weed, I guess. And so everyone who got put in that class just went and smoked together. It was like a meeting place for people who smoked.
Oh, I finally found my people.
Exactly.
It's like, I wonder if I should just smoke weed and meet the people. And then we can just go. Did you go get a house with them?
I did not. Oh, okay. I did not, actually.
Yeah. So beyond graduating with honors, fantastic.
Thank you.
And living off campus, you've been working on more and more music.
Yeah, that's my focus right now is I actually have an LP finished.
Whoa.
It is finished. It is done. It is sitting on my computer and several hard drives as backup. But before that, you know, I've got this single sort of package that just started coming out now, which you played first. Mm-hmm. And then we're doing another single package, I believe, in December, if that all works out properly, with another video and really cool remixes. So
what does a single package look like these days? Because back in my day, it was a maxi CD with, like, you know, the dance track and then, like, the radio edit.
It's sort of like that without the maxi CD. There's no maxi CD involved. It's very effervescent.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it lives in the between the ones and the zeros.
Exactly.
So it's the single.
And then for this one, You Turn Me Up, we have remixes from Susie Analog and from Fort Rameau, who's like a huge favorite of mine, so I'm really excited.
That's awesome.
It's really cool.
Did you make a video?
Yeah, there is a video. It's really cute. Can I just say that? It's so cute. It's an adorable video.
I just want to say that no one asked you about his cuteness, so you're bragging.
Is that a brag though, to say it's cute?
I don't know.
Is cuteness something you brag about? I just want to establish like the rules.
It depends on how you say it. what more?
If you're as cute as you, it is bragging.
Leading in for the comment. There it is. So what's the premise of the video? Did you come up with it?
Actually, the video for You Turn Me Up, I shot all myself on my iPhone, and it's me and my boyfriend in Munich.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is it like Roman Holiday type of thing?
Like, with a maybe less production value.
That's really cute. It's amazing that you can just shoot music videos on iPhones now.
It's really the future. It's the future.
It's the future. That's awesome. Did you edit it too?
I did.
You're good with all stuff. You're coding now too, right?
I am. Yeah, that's actually why, as you mentioned earlier, I was sort of curled up in this chair. I am doing a web development immersive, which is 9 to 5:30, homework till 10 every single weekday. It's sort of like a 3-month long development boot camp.
What are you doing it for?
I just like it.
Okay.
I just really like computers and programming. And it seemed like the right way to sort of really up my skills and sort of solidify them very quickly.
Yeah, nothing like going all in. I'm sure just if you were making sausage or writing a book or programming the web.
Exactly.
So the next single that's coming out, what do we got?
We've got a remix by Natasha Kmeto, which is really cool, and she's sort of, I think if you listen to her at all, she's sort of started to go in this more club friendly direction as opposed to like the sort of very like soulful R&B based things she was doing before. So it took a song that actually of mine, which is very slow, and sort of bumped it up, which I'm not used to. Usually it's the other way around, you know. Usually I'm making the dancey tracks and other people are slowing them down, making them sexy.
Oh yeah. Grown and sexy.
Yeah.
So the LP, this is your first one.
Yeah.
You excited?
I'm so excited, but I gotta be honest, it's really in the future. Like, I don't have anything set up in terms of, like, a date even. I can give you a year, 2014. And
Damien,
that's all I got for you.
What's up? No comment. No comment.
Classic PR.
Classic PR.
That's why he's here.
Do you have a name for the album?
I'm deciding between two, so I'm reluctant to commit.
Don't say it. It's like telling people your baby's name before the baby's born.
Exactly.
Did you enjoy writing it? I mean, was it a different process than putting out a single? Did you try and make like an album, or is it like 12 singles?
Well, this is sort of what I think, is that I have a pretty unique style. Because what I'm sort of doing is I'm never trying to take like a cultural thing or like make a cultural statement. You know what I mean? I don't find myself drawing on a lot of, like, specific styles in that, like, abstract sense. What I do comes from me, you know, in, like, this very, like, I don't know what the word is, like, sort of ridiculously artsy, like, I can't even help myself sense. Like, this is what I make. And I have tried so many times to make, like, specific genres or other things, and it always just sounds like me. So regardless of what sort of, like, concept I'm thinking of, or if I'm trying to make them sound cohesive, I think they are going to sound cohesive because I can't help myself.
That's great. Is it a concept album, though?
No, not really. I mean,
no.
No.
I wish you told people it was a concept album, and you're like, it's very obvious, and then just they're like, I don't see
it. No one gets it.
And no one gets it. So what do you got coming up for tour and everything?
Well, obviously I'm on a little hiatus because I literally don't have time to even grocery shop or, you know, go out on the weekends right now.
You're here.
I am here.
That's so appreciate
a
that.
Testament, I think, to how much I wanted to be here.
I really appreciate
I'm
it.
I'm awake. I'm here. The L isn't even running here right now, I think.
Oh my God. When is that L train going to get its shit together?
Who are you telling, man?
I feel like I've been here now for over 8 years, and then just every once in a while for like 3 or 4 months, I'd be like, nope.
No L train. Yeah.
We've decided to just permanently just dump all over everyone's plans for the weekend.
Forever. Indefinitely.
So you're on hiatus, but, I mean, you gotta do a little support with these EPs coming out.
Yeah, I absolutely intend to. I really want to be doing more DJ sets. That's something that's really fun for me and easier to set up. But I've also been working, when I do work on my live sets, I'm doing a lot more, like, stripped-down, involved stuff where you can see that I'm really building the tracks. Started working with the mono and a push, so it's a lot more live. And I'm really excited to sort of roll that out as time permits.
That's awesome. Well, when you put out the LP, you have to come back and we'll prep for a whole live performance.
Nice.
When you're not all coding and whatnot.
Deal.
So where can people find all the info? Where does Ducky live on the web?
DuckyMusic.com. D-U-C-K-Y music.com. Everything's there. I'm pretty present, you know. I got a SoundCloud. I got a Twitter.
How's your internet game?
My internet game is strong.
And it's getting stronger, right?
It's getting stronger every day. I actually even have now a place where I'm posting all my codes that I'm writing. So, like, if you want to see my progress as a coder, you can follow that as well.
What are you what are you coding?
Well, like, currently I'm just learning basic Ruby, and then I'm going to translate that into learning...
What's Ruby?
It's a programming language.
Okay.
It is a programming language. Actually, I think Ruby is one of the most intuitive because they sacrificed a lot of speed specifically for human readability. So if you compared it to something like C++, C++ is literally 80 times faster than Ruby in terms of processing power.
I think I can explain it in simple language. It's the programming language we use when you want to turn horses into glue.
Ah, yes. Real Greek programming.
Yes. Interesting. That's not necessarily the angle I would have taken. But.
You know, I just had that moment when I just felt all future technology pass me. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm like that grandpa saying, they were like, I don't know what this new, you know.
No, thing is. I think that's pretty common. I think that Ruby is not one that even a lot of people learning program learn at first. I think like college computer science courses, for example, are very Python heavy. And what I'm doing is very web-based, so Ruby's like a natural place to start.
I really wish you were just making up the names of these coding
languages. I swear I'm not. I swear.
You know, good old Boar's Head web. No, I mean, it's great. I mean, it's all the stuff where I look at it and I go, someone much smarter than me is figuring this out. Like someone who graduated honors from NYU. Mm-hmm. And is very cute.
Aww.
Well, Ducky, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you to everybody. This is episode 170. We're just marching right along. Next week we have more shows, and I don't know who they are because I don't have my notes in front of me. Actually, I take that back. Our good friend Joey's getting married, so we're kicking upstate to Maine. Destination wedding 2 hours north of Portland.
Wow.
Yeah. Bringing the dog. It's going to be great. Well, I want to thank everybody. Big shout out. Alan, congratulations. I'll see you at that party on Tuesday.
What's the name of the book?
From Scratch Inside the Food Network. And then a whole bunch of other stuff. That's not part of the official title, though, right?
No, the whole big personalities. What is it? Big personalities, high drama, the extraordinary behind-the-scenes story. No, that's totally unnecessary.
No, it's great, though. I want to go back and see what names I pitched you. It was very, like, pitch me, and you went, no. And I was like, oh, I've been in this room before. And Eli, thank you so much for swinging
for
in. We'll be back in 2 weeks, maybe with Greg. I think he'll be back in time. And we have Snacky Tunes Volume 4 live comp coming out on the 8th. You heard the opening track, which is Freelance Whales doing a cover of our wallpaper theme song. And we have our first bar food blowout at Park Slope on October 8th with Robbie from Morimoto. It's going to be good. We're doing the same thing with the barbecues, but it's high-end chefs doing their take on bar food. Cheap ticket, good food, good beer. Lots of fun. Thanks for listening. Shout out to Roberta's Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back soon and keep on keeping on.
That was fun. Yeah, great job.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today.
Thanks for listening.